David, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Good to come on. I'm hoping for a good chat, obviously, because I know you've had a lot of good guests on. So hopefully I can add a couple of things maybe that people haven't done before. I'm not so confident about that, but we'll see. But looks like you're doing some great work. So thank you very much for having me on.
No problem at all. Really looking forward to this episode. I know we talked a little bit kind of before we started recording about a few of the things I wanted to get into today, and I think there is a lot that strength and conditioning coaches, performance coaches, whatever you want to call it, can learn about the things that you do in particular. And I've been obviously very impressed with like some of the work that you've been putting out over the last year in particular. But before we kind of get into the details of that and what that looks like, for those that maybe haven't heard of you, why don't you just give us a quick kind of rundown on who you are, kind of what you've been doing?
Yeah, I'll make it as quick as I can and as brief as I can. So I'm in Ireland, obviously, as people might be able to hear, but I work with a lot of rehab movement, kind of spills into performance stuff with clients, gen pop and athletes, and some very good athletes and some average athletes. So it's nice to have the mix of that, and it's nice to be able to learn from all different people and apply things and stress test your different principles and concepts with different populations. And I love working with like the elite of the elite, but it's really cool for me to be able to work with all different types of people. And it's nice to see that the things that would like the same things work, to be honest, the same things work. It's just more stress, more volume, more intensity for higher level athletes. So yeah, I've been kind of on a journey myself, I suppose, for the last 10 or so years as an athlete and myself, who was average at best and struggled a lot with a lot of injuries, a lot of pain, and a lot of frustration and things that I just could not get right, despite trying to go and see all, quote unquote, the best of the best, and I couldn't really get help. And it was often like one step forward, two steps back. There was not things that I was hearing or being told about my body didn't really make that much sense, and didn't really help, to be honest. So that kind of set me on a journey of trying to figure things out for myself. And when I say myself, it's not like I was sitting down just writing things out. I was just chatting to as many people as I could and getting different ideas and studying different methods and systems and trying to just pull out bits and pieces, whatever made sense to me. And I was very much learning as I went. Like I didn't really have a template in mind where I was trying to fit ideas into that. It was very much an open book because this was my education and all these courses I was going to with other coaches and with therapists and with some of the smartest minds in the world. I was a blank slate because I had no previous education before that. So I was learning and hearing ideas and learning anatomy and biomechanics and physiology in a very, I suppose, practical way. And my judgment, I suppose, on whether these things were valuable or not was, did it help me? Did it make sense to my body? And not just pain-wise, but just movement and how did that feel? Could someone explain it in a way that actually made sense? And so I look back now and I obviously understand that just because it didn't help me, it might not have been valuable. And I realize that now. But I do think I was, if there's one thing I'll give myself credit for, it's being able to identify when I think someone is talking crap or not, and trying to learn from the people who are not talking crap. And I have fallen into some holes in the past where I've probably listened to people for too long that actually, looking back now, probably weren't doing an amazing job. But in saying that, I think I'm good at, even though maybe I've invested and gone down that route, I've kind of been good at saying, actually, hang on, step back here. Like, you've invested, you've probably spent a lot of time and money on this, but it's probably not working, and step away from it. And I think other people probably, not everyone, but a lot of people just keep going down further and further and further because they're already invested in that. So yeah, I've just spent probably 10 years traveling and working and learning and applying more than anything else, just applying things and trying to get the best results I could with myself and the people I work with. So it's kind of taken me to the point where I'm doing a lot of work online, obviously with COVID, and businesses is doing pretty well. helping a lot of people, which is cool, and making mistakes on a daily basis and trying to learn from them, I suppose. But that's kind of led me to where I am now, and I'm pretty happy with that, and just trying to keep getting better if I can.
Yeah, I mean that's a great story, and I think it's actually really interesting the amount of people that I speak to that go on this journey to help themselves and to find out that it's always like similar to myself, like our average athlete, we want to get better at our sport and be able to help to be healthy to do our sport. And so that sends you on this journey of discovery and self-discovery and everything else. But there was actually one thing that I wanted, that you said, that I picked up on a little bit, and that was almost that bullshit detector, so to speak. And I think there's a lot of young coaches that listen to this kind of podcast. And I was just wondering, if you touched on it a little bit, is there anything that you could advice that you could give to them that will help them kind of have a better bullshit detector, so to speak?
It is a tough question, but it's an important question. So you should try things on yourself. Now that doesn't mean to say that, right, like there's the other side of that story where people would say, well, if you can't do it yourself, you can't teach anyone else to do it. And I actually disagree with that, because I'm never going to be able to sprint as fast as Usain Bolt, but if he came to me with a knee injury, I think I could help him. And I might not be able to squat as heavy as some of these powerlifters or whatever, but I think I can see things in their body and try and figure it out, even if I don't love back squatting myself very much. So there's two sides to the coin. But what I would say is the people that are teaching a lot of things that in my mind very clearly don't work, but they might be very charismatic around how they teach, or kind of just shout louder than maybe anyone else in the industry about what they teach. If people tried it on themselves and didn't just take things on for face value, they would realize that their body does not feel better when they do it. They would just, if you have any awareness of your body, you realize this doesn't work. And to be honest, for a lot of the like therapists, I know we're talking about coaches, but if you look at a lot of therapists who treat people and they do a lot of passive techniques, don't offer any movement interventions or strengthening interventions, if they had pain themselves and did that, they would understand that their pain is not probably going away and they're not moving better, not getting stronger. So that in that world, you should be able to test something on yourself and see some sort of result. And I think people are not doing that. So that's one way of having a bullshit detector. The second way is remembering your principles. So things can get very fancy, but what are the principles that underpin human movement and adaptation and physiology and all of these things? And it doesn't have to get very, very fancy. And there's a lot of coaches out there seeing an exercise on Instagram and saying, I'm going to use that exercise. And here's the exercise of the day. I'm going to use that with all my clients. And if they don't understand the principles, the attractors of certain movements that we're trying to get, then the exercise actually might be good, but it's pointless if the intention isn't right behind it. So I guess it does come back to your first principles, like your biomechanics, your just how a human body will adapt or should adapt. And so what I think is bullshit, someone else might not think is bullshit because they have a different understanding of biomechanics than me. But I would say that they don't have as good an understanding as me. They probably say that I don't have as good an understanding as them, but I think we should have just solid intentions. And then when we see different things, we can take it and try it and say, okay, what am I trying to gain from this? And does it work or not? So it all comes back to one thing, which is test and retest. And if I test and retest, my whatever outcome I'm trying to improve should get better. And there's a lot of people marketing and selling things, and there is no test and retest because it just looks fancy, it looks good, and it's marketable, but it's not actually improving people. So have a test and retest is probably the biggest advice I would say.
Yeah, and I think with that test and retest, whatever kind of world you're in, whether it be I suppose that's maybe a bad way to describe it, but we'll call it just general performance, health and performance. It's always important to test and retest with your athletes, so you know obviously if they're improving or not improving. Otherwise, what's the point in doing it? What mm-hmm. we did in the first place. And I think if you can't kind of maybe quantify something, then you're probably going to be struggling to kind of, I think, sell your product in the future as well. It's kind of that short term. But while you're kind of on that, or while we're on that that area, what are the typical problems that you do see with clients that kind of come to you that have maybe got a, this can be general pop as well, but I'm going to say maybe come from a more formal strength conditioning background or performance background. So maybe some of your performance athletes versus some of your general pop athletes. Is there any differences there?
Yeah. So your gen pop people, there's no difference, right? In terms of the human body is the human body. All our bones are shaped like they're different, but almost the exact same. They can go into similar ranges of motion. Now, some person might have more range than another person, but they're still going in the same direction with the bones. So bones can move the same way. We'll all adapt similarly enough, some faster, some slower. But we would expect when I stress this thing, it's going to, if I stress it well enough at the right amount, it's going to adapt in this way. So we should have an understanding of that. Now, gen pop, when we come to like injury and pain and movement, if there's someone who hasn't done much training before, and let's take nutrition as a better example. If there's someone who is very, very overweight, and I just tell them to eat a salad, that will work because they're not eating McDonald's 5 times a day anymore. So if there's an elite athlete who's been performing at the top of their game and they have a nutritionist, then they're looking for the extra 1 or 2 or 5 or 10% gains, then telling them to eat a salad is probably not going to help them. Okay. So if we take that back to the movement world, if someone has never trained before and I give them a clam exercise as activation for their glute, that actually might help their knee pain because they're just getting a muscular contraction and gotten off the couch for the first time in 2 years. So any of these things will probably help because it's better than what they were doing, which was nothing or very little. If we try to do a glute clam exercise, which has all these EMG studies behind it, but actually who cares, because an elite athlete, they're just doing so much more. They're already strong. Then we have to be able to ask better questions. And I see the same granny doing the same rehab exercises as an elite athlete, and that might be fine for a post-op, like someone who's just come out of a surgery, an elite athlete. Then I'm finding a way to get the muscles to just keep pumping and firing. But if we're asking higher level questions with higher level athletes, then those things are just not going to work. But unfortunately, those are the things that people are still being prescribed. And it's just off the back of, here's what gets the biggest contraction through that muscle. But that's not what they're missing, usually, almost ever, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. So we've got to start asking better questions and finding better solutions for those higher level athletes.
Yeah, exactly. And that comes back to pretty much every day I'll deal with someone who they have to come to me privately because their club or their whoever are their themselves, their own physios that they hire, have not done a good enough job with them. And that's not a slight on that person, that physio or that therapist or whatever, but they're coming to me because the traditional things that they've been taught have not helped them. And I'm not surprised. And if we just ask why once, so if someone says your glute isn't activating, that's the reason for your knee pain, then if I just ask why is your glute not activating, that person can't give me an answer. So we should be able to ask why, and you should have an answer as to why it's not activating. Mm-hmm. If you're giving an exercise, why are you giving that exercise? Because this muscle needs to be stronger. Well, why is that muscle stronger on your right side and not on your left side? So it's just simple why questions. And when we start to ask those questions, people get lost. And that should be a big red flag as to they're throwing shit at a wall and hoping that something sticks.
I think like what you said there with why, and that's something that I've tried to, I actually took it from Keo when I'm flat. And it's kind of, I call it the 5 whys. Mm-hmm. It's when I'm putting something into a program, mm-hmm. or exactly like what you said then, or your glutes not activating, why? like whatever, and it's if they can't give that reason, or maybe they give one reason because it's, I don't know, not strong enough, then why is it not strong enough? And, and you can just keep going down that rabbit hole. Now, if I can answer why to myself five times, then it's okay, well, I'll probably keep the exercise in the program. And I think it's being able to have that higher level of critical thinking. Now, it's not easy. I've really struggled with it at times myself. But I think if you can really challenge yourself to think like that, then it's only going to be better for your athletes and definitely yourself in the long run.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it is. It's a challenge because the easiest thing in the world is for me to just throw out a willy-nilly answer where it's like, oh, look, it's this. And actually, it's rarely this. It's usually a combination of things, and everything should make sense. Like when an athlete is in pain, and pain is the thing that probably makes sense least in the world. Is so complex and so tricky, and I could have 6 months of zero pain, and then I wake up and I ate something that didn't agree with me, and now I have knee pain again. So it's very tricky, but. If we ask good questions and really dig into things, and this goes for performance and movement as well, if we ask good questions, we should see why there is limitations or lack of performance or pain or issues there. We should start to get an understanding of the picture. And I think that's just people. This is what people should do. That's not my job, but the therapists or the coaches that I work with and try and help and train and stuff like that, the only thing I'm trying to develop in them is critical thinking, really, more than anything else. It's not use my system or my exercise or anything like that. It's just, here's how you can critically think, here's what you're trying to see, here's the questions you're trying to ask, and from that you can start to build a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you mentioned that you get various athletes or potentially, mainly athletes coming to you that haven't quite had the success they'd have hoped for with their maybe club teams or individual coaches, whatever that they've been working with. So what do you think that, if we stick with maybe the S&C coaches here, for example, what do you think that S&C coaches can do better to maybe avoid these problems or solve these problems for the athletes? Is there something that you think strength conditioning coaches maybe missing in their education, or is it maybe we're just so blinded by like the weight room? Big question.
Yeah, big question. And I don't ever want people to think that I like think I have the answers. I definitely don't. But good question. Definitely blinded by the weight room. Definitely. After the first couple of years of beginner gains for someone, there's not that much gains left in the weight room, apart from like hopefully injury prevention and just all of these things. Like there's not massive gains left in the weight room. And I think as coaches get more and more experienced and they start to look at the top guys, most of the top guys are saying the same thing. And so that is one thing. I would say, I think the weight room is invaluable. But I think it's done pretty poorly also. And that means there's definitely a lack of variability, and it's very much influenced by powerlifting. Mm-hmm. And all the positions and lifts that you see have come from powerlifting. If we just go back a couple of hundred years, that's where it started usually. And it's continued to go through that way. And it's a great way of getting very, very strong and incredibly stiff and losing a lot of movement at your joints. So if we want to talk about joints, the feet, the pelvis, the rib cage, the more people go down the traditional powerlifting route, the more they lose variability, a lot of movement options around those areas. And which is really good if you're a powerlifter, because you don't want much variability there. You want to be as stiff as possible, and I want to be able to go down and back up again, and I don't want any movement left or right from that. But that's how we're training our athletes as well, who need to go onto the field or the court or whatever it is and actually move in three dimensions. So there's an argument against that as well, and people will say that actually they're getting that variability from their sport, and then we need to just train them very strict in the gym. I would disagree with that. I understand the argument, but I would disagree with that, because their sport is usually pushing them towards extension as well, extension based postures. Like a lot of athletes will be there, and then we push them into the gym and they train like that, and then they leave the gym, and it's actually they're not able to relax, they're not able to let go, they're not introducing these motions back into their body that we need to stress. And there's also a brain involved that needs to feel these different areas. There's a sensory aspect, and that's why having a more broad training plan where I hit different ranges of motion, different joints, different planes of motion is very important, because the brain is constantly mapping the body and adapting to the highest amount of stress that we're putting on it. And if we're always putting on the same amount of stress with my chest up in the air and my pelvis forward, then that is actually how I'm going to carry myself around the world when I leave the gym. So there's a lot.
Those spectrums are kind of spectrum. On the field, we're getting full extension. On the gym, we're getting extension, and there's nothing kind of bringing us back to neutral in the middle.
Very little. Yeah, very little. And we'll see that. We'll see that athletes, as the years go by, you could test their hip range of motion every 6 months for 5 years, and you'll see that every single 6 months it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse, and suddenly I hit a problem because I have a lack of variability. And people will then say that they do train variability, they do train that, because instead of doing a back squat, I do a single leg squat. But I would disagree with that. Like, if we have rib cage here, so if this is what your back squat looks like, chest up in the air, spine in a lot of extension, and then I say I'm training variability now, I'm actually doing a split squat and my spine still looks like this. It's just that I have one leg forward and one leg back, and my pelvis is the exact same. It looks like this on two legs and it looks like this on one leg. Then I would argue that is not variability. It's just finding a different way to do the exact same thing.
Does that change at all if you go like true single leg squat, in terms of more like maybe a pistol or a skater squat? Do you see any differences in kind of pelvis, rib cage positioning there?
Yeah, they'll probably be forced to get their center of mass more on top of one leg. And then they'll be forced to probably not extend as much, because you won't be able to, if you're more on a single leg, you have to stay stacked a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So you have to be maybe kind of here instead of being here. Mm-hmm. And as I go down, I'll probably have to stay stacked a little bit better. It is hard to overload those things, but even in a split squat, you can do a lot of nice things. It's just it comes back to what we spoken about at the start. What are the principles that you're trying to adhere to? And if I'm on my left leg and I'm trying to load my left leg, my center of mass should be on top of my left leg, not kind of between both legs. Mm-hmm. And I should probably have a pelvis that is rotated a little bit to the left, and a rib cage. Well, there's an argument there. It could be left or it could be gone back to the right to get that counter rotation. But we need to have the center of mass more on top of the front leg rather than between both legs, with both sides of the pelvis kind of facing forward. Mm-hmm. Because if we're trying to train stance phase of gait, whether it's early, mid or late stance, most people, you'll watch this. And again, you'll see that, right, I do my right leg forward, and my pelvis actually is good at rotating to the right a little bit on top of that right leg. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do my left leg forward and my pelvis is still rotated right. So they'll say I'm doing single leg to even out the asymmetries, but they're not. The pelvis is pointing to the right on both sides. And I say the right because it will usually be the right, just because of our asymmetries as human beings.
Is there anything we can do from a strength conditioning kind of practitioner perspective to try and balance that out? Is that something that we just need to do a better job of kind of eyeballing that, or what do you think?
Yeah, understanding it first, understanding the natural human asymmetries that present, and that most people will want to present with more weight on their right leg, more weight on their right heel, more weight on kind of the left midfoot and a more pronated left foot. And that the ribs then will usually be either flared on the left rib or flared on both ribs. Mm-hmm. And when it's flared on the left, you'll usually see like that kind of pushes me right. And when it's flared on both, then it kind of just pushes me forward. Now the left will still probably be more flared, but it just pushes me forward on my feet more. And I'm very much in that extension based posture. And for instance, people would talk about things like, or someone has a lack of dorsiflexion, that's why they can't squat down But actually, they're probably just starting in dorsiflexion already. There's no room left to go. And when I do present like that, I can't really shift my weight to the left or the right. Everything is just forward, and my back extensors are on because they're trying to stop me from falling over. They're trying to pull me back. Mm-hmm. So this is why people will start to talk about glutes that don't activate. One, they obviously do activate their working, but two is they can't get into any kind of optimal length tension relationship because ribs come up, pelvis tilts forward, and now I have back extensors instead of hip extensors working.
Is that because the body is, like you said there, it's almost, is it like the stumble reflex that's kind of kicking in there like a little bit because we're getting into that extended posture position?
Yeah, a lot of reflex, basically every reflex in our body, or a lot of the reflexes that are built into us, are to stop us from falling over.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They do not, our brain, like if you think about just going back 10,000 years, a million years, you're in nature. If you fall over, you're probably dead meat. Mm-hmm. So we can't fall over. So our brain, like the people who are talking about trying to get people's backs to relax and their extensors to just relax and chill out a little bit, so I get glute instead of lower back, they don't understand that it's never going to happen. It's never going to relax because your center of mass is always going this direction. It's always going forward. So my brain says, well, he's trying to tell me to chill out my back, but if I do, I'm going to fall over. So what's he going to choose? A conscious contraction or else, okay, I don't want to die here. So, and if you can get the back to relax, the toes are going to grip and the calves are going to kick in to stop me falling over. So we can't override these things with conscious thought, really. We have to just understand what underpins muscle activation, facilitation, inhibition, and a lot of it is position of the bones.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's really interesting. That kind of leads me on, we'll kind of take a half step back here. But, and I know a lot of this stuff that we've just talked about there is essentially going to answer some of this next question. But what are you looking at then when you first take on a client or an athlete to kind of identify maybe some of those issues that you just touched on?
Yeah. So range of motion is a big one. Now, at the moment, I probably can't check too many people's range of motion on the table. And I know that a lot of people here are strength coaches, so they're probably not putting their hands on people to check them like that anyway. And luckily, you don't need to. If you're smart about what you're trying to look at, you can learn a lot of things. So the movements that people are probably checking anyway with their clients when they're assessing them are the movements that you can learn so much about range of motion if you know what you're looking for. So I'll get someone to do a toe touch. So it'll just forward bend and touch their toes. I want to know. So, and all forward bends, all toe touches are not created equal. So if someone can touch their toes, they can touch the floor, palm the floor, but their back has not rounded, I would say that is a very, very bad thing. I'm not loving a client that can do that because they have not flexed through their spine at all. And they probably have very, very lengthened hamstrings, really long hamstrings. And that's not so good for me.
That's where it comes back to being told that, oh, we need long hamstrings.
No, we don't need long hamstrings. we need shorter hamstrings than most people have already. Even if you can't reach past your knees, probably not your hamstrings. So basically we want to see this nice even curve through the spine. So a toe touch is going to tell us so much about how well I can flex my spine. How well I can flex my spine tells me so much about how well I can relax. Can I just let go? Because if I'm sitting on the couch, you see someone who moves well and can be really relaxed. They'll sit on the couch, they'll just slouch and they'll be always trying to move, find a comfortable position. How's my posture? What way should I be aligned when I'm sitting down? No, you just can't relax. That's your problem. So the spine kind of flex is really important. Kind of get a nice even flexion. And if it can't, it's not telling us what we need to stretch or strengthen. It's telling us where I can't get airflow. So what parts of my thorax can I not get expansion in? which tells me a lot about the nervous system. So if you can't flex and relax and go down to touch your toes, you're probably in a fight or flight because you have a lot of extensor tone. And again, going back to what we said before, extensor tone is trying to stop me from falling over. Stop me from falling over is a chest and is not a chest breather. That's wrong. The rib cage will elevate as I inhale. I'm using a lot of neck. And that's, again, someone that can't relax. So toe touch will tell me so much. And just call me up if I'm probably going a little bit all over the place here. But a toe touch tells me so much about someone's spine, which is obviously very important. And so much about how well they can just relax their body and shut things off. And which is going to tell you how well they sleep and breathe and all of those things. So you can do it. You can check a spinal extension. So they kind of do an arch back. And you just want to see like an even extension through the spine. So the spine will tell you a lot of things. You can do a rotation, see a twist to the left, twist to the right, and that'll tell you a lot about the feet and the hips. So if I'm standing there and I just rotate my whole body to the left, I should see a left foot that was going to pronate as I rotate left and a right foot that's going to supinate. And then as I twist to the right or twist to the left, I should see right foot pronate, left foot supinate. So it tells me a lot about the feet, which obviously tells you about the knees, which tells you about rotation through the hips. So simple movements is just being able to eyeball things and see it in real time and understand what you're actually seeing. Mm-hmm. And then you can do a lateral flexion where you just side bend, which is, again, what a lot of people will check. And what you're seeing there a lot of the time is a frontal plane at the pelvis. So as I reach my hand down along my right leg, I'm probably going to need to shift my pelvis over to the left to counterbalance. And as I reach down along my left leg, I'm probably going to need to shift my pelvis to the right to counterbalance. And that will, as I go right, I'm going to be left with a right hip that adducts, adducts, and a left hip that abducts, and then the opposite is here. So now I'm checking frontal plane at the hips, which goes back to the split squats and stuff that we're talking about. Because if I can't adduct one hip in gait, I can't get my center of mass on top of that leg. Mm-hmm. And so when I split squat, of course, I'm not going to get my mass on top of a leg. I'm going to be between both legs. So I can't really even load very well through one leg. So they're simple movements that you can check. And I'm not expecting people to have listened to all this. Some people might want to watch it back. Some people might want to turn off the video. Hopefully they don't do that. But if they watch it back, it might sound like I'm saying a lot of stuff, but actually it's very, very simple. Really, really simple. It's just simple movements of the bones. And you don't want to see one joint doing a huge movement and the next joint doing nothing. You just want to see this load sharing through the joints and that everything can kind of move. And for me, that's injury prevention. It's that everything can load equally or share the load. And so when I go and actually move, one thing is not getting overloaded all the time. And then obviously another movement then to check is just the squat as well. And what you see a lot of the time is someone is going to go to squat down. And if you look at them from the back, you'll see them shift into their right hip a lot of the time like this. So they shift back into the right hip. And again, that's because they're probably... Well, they're a human being who loves to shift to the right side. So it tells you a lot about the range of motion at the hips as well. So
why is it that kind of right side is the dominant side there?
There's a lot of reasons. And this is something that PRI speaks about, Postural Restoration Institute. They've done a brilliant job with this. But basically, we're asymmetrical at our internal organs. So I have a heart more to the left side. Mm-hmm. I have an extra lobe lung on the right side. I have a lower attachment to my diaphragm on the right side. So it has a kind of a stronger line of pull. My visual system isn't symmetrical. My brain isn't symmetrical. There's so many things in my body. So, but more than anything else, it's how I breathe pulls me right as a human being. Mm-hmm. It pulls me to the right side. And that's, for a strength coach to hear that might sound weird, but that's why the breathing stuff is so important. You will never do a good job of changing someone's range of motion at their hips if they breathe like crap.
So you think that is important to get away from that weight shift that you see there? Then we need to try and correct that.
Yeah, we want to. It'll never be perfect. It'll always be biased over that side, especially when I'm stressed. I see this 100 clients out of 100. I'm not making this up. It's every, so when you know what to look at, you'll see it 100 out of 100. And it will never be perfect. It will never be, when someone gets really stressed, they will never shift their weight to the left side unless they were born with their organs the other way around. So this is why extension, more extension in the gym, more and more and more extension. More extension is going to push me right, because more extension is more stress through the system. Mm-hmm. Means I'm going right, and now I'm struggling to get really well on top of my left side, struggling to resupinate my left foot, all of these things. So you'll see a lot of lateral hip issues on the right side because they're kind of pushed in there a lot. Uh-huh. You'll see a lot of right groin issues because they're being pulled into the right groin a lot. Probably when I have a client and they fill in my pre-intake form and they say right proximal adductor issues or right groin issues. Or no, sorry, excuse me. They say adductor issues or groin issues. I'm just presuming that it's on the right side. Mm-hmm. They don't need to tell me right or left.
Just kind of makes sense it's going that way. And then, so you've mentioned quite a few things then. You mentioned some potentially, well, really simple tests, toe touch, rotation, the arch back, kind of getting into extension and things. What, as a kind of a younger coach that's maybe listening to this and watching it and be like, oh, that's some really good information, but how do I know what exactly what I'm looking for? Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of advice that you would give there just to be able to kind of break that down maybe a little bit more into its component parts? Or if in a lot of college strength conditioning coaches in the US who work with like large groups, how do you think that kind of can be able to implement it on a larger scale?
Yeah, it's tricky. It's definitely tricky. So the first thing is just practice. It's like everything else. It's just practice. It's asking people to do it, to do these little things, and just start to observe. Don't put a good or bad label on it. Just observe what you're seeing, and you'll start to see things. And most people will be able to see that when someone flexes down, here's the areas that don't flex in their spine. There's a chunk there that doesn't flex. And so that's important. We'd like to get that to flex. It's not that flexion is better than extension. It's just that I want these areas to be able to move, you know? So they don't have to move. They don't have to be perfect. Not saying that these things are going to cause pain, because again, pain is so complex. But if you offered me if I was in a shop and you said to me, there's a spine that 2/3 of it doesn't move, there's a spine that does move, I'd say I'd buy that one. I'll take the spine that moves, you know. And I think most people would take that. So just look at what's, try and observe what's moving and what's not moving. And in large groups, it's hard. It is definitely hard. But you can still observe these things when you're prescribing their lifts, whatever lifts they're doing, their back squat, their front squat, their deadlift. You'll still see the same things again. People will extend through certain areas, flex through certain areas, move through certain areas over and over again. And that's telling you, ultimately, I don't really need to look at those tests that much anymore, because I just get people to show me the movements that they're doing and we'll be able to see it there. But I'm not expecting people to be amazing at that straight away, because it's been probably 10 years of practice that I've put into it. Yeah. And I'm not saying I'm amazing either. There's people out there, like, I've learned a lot of this stuff from Gary Ward, Dave O'Sullivan. You'll see PRI, Ron Horoska talking about these things. Like, they're amazing at seeing people moving. And we're traditionally told that strength is the answer to everything and biomechanics is not that important. I would argue with that, because the people who are saying biomechanics are not that important, I see one, they have no idea how to assess these things. And two, they have no idea how to change biomechanics. Mm-hmm. So they don't have a right to say it's not important, because they don't know how to change it. They can't retest. They don't know because they can't retest, because they can't change anything.
I think when it comes to like biomechanics is everything, really, because it's like joint position. So that bone position that we talk about, it dictates the muscle function. Mm-hmm. So, and if you can't really understand that, then you can't really go about doing anything, in my opinion. And I think just one thing to kind of close up that bit that you were talking about there is, I think we can look at a lot of things, and there's like you said earlier, there's so many different things going on. I think for these younger coaches, it's important to emphasize, don't get kind of lost in that paralysis by analysis, kind of just kind of maybe look at one thing and focus on that. And then don't try to look at the whole chain or anything. That would be kind of my advice, unless you've got something different there.
No, that's it. Like, that's it. Just start slow. Start small. That's what I'm saying. Just look, try and start to look at how people do a toe touch, and just look at, because traditionally we would say, can you touch your toes? Yes, good. Or no, bad. Actually, how do you perform the movement? How do you achieve these movements? What joints are, is someone hyperextending their knees back to get down? And that will tell me a lot about how they're going to run and walk, because they know that they haven't flexed their spine. They haven't, they've hyperextended their knees. So now the hamstring is probably being lengthened from both ends. Going to get a lot of quad, a lot of knee extension. And when they go and run, we'll either get a lot of knee extension or a lot of hip extension. And I know that person is going to, their brain is going to choose knee extension instead of hip extension. And for me, that goes back to principles. That's a big thing that I don't want from my athletes. I want them to be able to get a really active hip extension using their glutes and their hip extensors rather than a knee extension, which straightens their knee and then they have to pull themselves forward with their lower back instead. So it comes back to timing. So that's why I'm saying, like, the toe touch is so important. These little movements are so important. They're not, most people that are checking range of motion, it's an arbitrary thing. They'll say, oh, we'd love you to be able to get hip flexion or extension, but they don't know how that feeds into how someone actually moves and why someone is missing these ranges. And if we start to put the pieces together, we'll say, well, you're missing that range at the hip, but it's actually because maybe your foot can't do X, Y, or Z, and so it has no choice to be there.
So it comes back again to that, looking at the bigger global picture and then asking why, just going kind of digging.
Just
moving on slightly then. If we look at, I want to talk a little bit around the foot, the pelvis, and the rib cage. You've mentioned breathing there. Is one, this could be a stupid question, so feel free to completely throw it
out. There's no stupid questions. It's stupid answers.
Is one more important than the other in terms of the foot, the rib, the pelvis, or the rib cage, or are they equally as important in kind of getting everything right? And then, so I've been going through your lower body basics program. And it's been very insightful for me. I thought I was better than I was. So it's like a very humbling program. Obviously there's a lot of breathing exercises in there as well. Do you mind? I'm not sure where you want to go with this. If you want to say that, like, start with the foot and maybe work the way up, but do you mind talking through that? And then within that, maybe kind of an interest of mine is kind of, a lot of people talk about the big toe fire in the glute. Where does that kind of come into it? What does that even mean? Because I think people talk about it and don't actually understand it. If you could kind of, I know there's a lot in that question again, but if you could kind of run with that however you feel fit, then that would be awesome.
Yeah, I'll try and break it down, and I might have to ask you to go again, but yeah. Just on the one, is one more important than the other? Yes and no. We probably can't say one is more important, because everything has an influence on everything else. And so if my foot's a mess, it's going to have an influence on my hip. If my hip's a mess, it's going to have an influence on my foot. So everything is important, and we have to remember that and try and understand through someone's movement patterns and injury history and all these different things, what thing is having the influence. So, like, what's coming along for the ride and what's driving this. So for instance, we might see that someone, like I was saying, the hip extension versus the knee extension, we might see that for one person they had a bad injury in the hamstring, and the distal hamstring is really weak now and really poor, and so that distal hamstring can't contract to delay knee extension happening. And so I get a lot of knee extension, I don't get much glute. So there's one reason for someone not getting enough glute actually actively pushing me forward, because it's put into end range very soon, because the hamstring can't stop the knee from extending before the hip is extended. Okay, so there's one reason that someone might can't get enough glute. Now, when my distal hamstring can't do that, my pelvis, because the knee goes into extension very soon, my pelvis is going to go into an anterior tilt very soon. And now I obviously can't get much glute from there. Okay, the other reason that someone might get, and that might lead someone to be a cranky knee then, because it's not very stable at that point either. The other reason why someone might end up in that position is they're very stressed. They have had a massive row with their wife or whatever, or they just have really poor breathing habits that have been developed over years, or they don't sleep well and all these other things. Or someone trained them really poorly to say that they should always have their shoulders back and their breathing is now destroyed. So ribs are flared up. When ribs are flared up, pelvis is going to tilt forward. And now my distal hamstring can't delay knee extension because it's in a poor position to do that. So I'm in the same position, but one is because I hurt my hamstring before. One is because I'm stressed and I don't breathe very well. Either way, the glute is in the middle and people will say you need to activate your glute. But neither of those people need to activate their glute. They need to get better position at the ribs or better ability for the hamstring to co-contract with the quad and the calf. Okay, so nothing is more important than the other. In saying that, I would probably bias the thorax usually first. And I'll contradict myself and say this is probably more important, but not for everyone. It's just that we need to know each individual. But in general, I want this to be very, very good up here, because this is probably having the biggest impact on the rest of my bones and my neurology as well. So I won't give feet exercises to everyone. I won't give hamstring exercises to everyone, excuse me. Every single person I've ever worked with for the last few years and will continue to work with has probably been given a breathing exercise. Mm-hmm. And it's not breathing exercises to get them to connect with God or anything like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I want the thorax to be moving well and them to be able to manage air pressure. Okay. Because that's going to have a massive impact on everything else. So everything is just as important as each other, but also this is more important.
essentially the glutes just get, it's kind of the middle of the chain. So yeah. Everyone just is like, oh, it's got to be the glutes, when it could be definitely above the chain or below the chain. So if we keep going down that kind of potential rabbit hole that is the rib cage and breathing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people talk about, oh, we need to belly breathe, we've got to expand the diaphragm, et cetera, et cetera. Some of your, as part of your program that I've been doing, has been kind of inhaling into the chest a little bit more, expanding the rib cage. Do you mind just kind of talking about why that's important and why we should be doing that?
Yeah. Just go back to the same things again. It's people talk about belly breathing because that's what's being taught for a long time, and yoga will teach it and all these things, but there's no reasoning behind it. It doesn't make sense. It's the belly should expand, but so should the rest of the rib cage. And people are being taught to only belly breathe and just expand the belly. And where are your lungs? They're not in your belly. Now I know the diaphragm will descend down and the belly will expand, but the lungs should be, we should be getting expansion inside the rib cage in 360 degrees. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something like 136 joints in the thorax. So that's a hell of a lot of joints. And this goes back to our conversation earlier about variability. Mm-hmm. Variability is not a rib cage that doesn't move and a belly that just expands. Variability is every single inhale I take and exhale I take, all of those joints are being brought through some range of motion. And that's so much feedback from my brain. When joints don't move, I'm missing so much sensory information. It's like saying, close your eyes and walk around. Your brain needs access to the outside world, and it gets that through sensory information. So eyes, ears, touch, taste, and feedback from the structures. And the only way it gets feedback from the structures is when it moves. Mm-hmm. And belly breathing, it forces this to get incredibly stiff, and I end up, where do I end up again? Belly expands, ribs are going to flare up, pelvis is going to tip forward,
And now I'm the guy who doesn't have glutes again. It's not, they're not, I'm not getting an active hip extension. I'm getting back extension instead. Mm-hmm. So belly breathing is the same thing again. So it's just people that don't understand how the bones should move. Mm-hmm. So it's not that it's bad. It's just not great. yeah, we need to be able to expand that. And so like the glutes not activating, the weak hamstrings, the chest up in the gym all the time, the should stand with a military posture, they all push me to the same position, mm-hmm. again and again and again, which is this position.
And where do we see
stressful position? And now I can't sleep. And where do we see hamstring injuries happening? Again, it's in this position. It's when the pelvis goes into an anterior tilt usually. And now there's a way, way, way more research to be done on that. I'm not saying this is the only factor. There's so many factors, and strength is a big factor as well. And just load management is a huge factor, obviously. But we see a lot of hamstrings getting hurt in this position. Mm-hmm. And those same people that I see with recurring hamstring injuries that RDLs aren't helping and Nordic curls aren't helping, they're doing their RDLs and their Nordic curls in this position again with the ribs flared up, and they just cannot expand the back of the rib cage. They have absolutely no chance of doing that. It's completely closed off. There's no expansion there, which also means there's very little rotation there. Mm-hmm. And strength coaches will understand this. I know a lot of these topics might be different, might be new, but they will understand this. How important is the thoracic spine to get movement through it, especially for rotational athletes, mm-hmm. or for anyone, to be honest. Any human being should be able to move well through there. But they're doing a lot of thoracic spine opening drills. But what opens a thoracic spine is airflow pushing into these areas and expanding the back of the rib cage. And I should have a rib cage that can go pump, pump, pump. So my right side expands, my left side closes off, and it pumps like this. That's actually what drives movement into the thoracic spine. So rib movement drives movement into the spine. Most people are trying to drive movement into the spine and are skipping the rib cage. Okay, so strength coaches will understand how important thoracic spine movement is. But I think they go about it the wrong way.
So you think there's some bigger, kind of easier, lower hanging fruit, so to speak, to get hold of, and if we go through some proper kind of breathing exercises, ribcage expansion, instead of just maybe sitting in some like T-spine rotation for 30 to 45 seconds or whatever it might be.
Yeah, and that's hopefully not me talking crap, because if you were with me or someone else was with me, we would assess someone, mm-hmm. do an exercise that I think was based on the assessment of breathing exercise, drive airflow into the right area. And if I've assessed it right and I've guessed it right and I've coached it right, all of their measurements that I wanted to improve should have improved within 3, 4, 5 breaths. Mm-hmm. So it's not guesswork. It's not theory. It's very, very practical.
Yeah.
It is guesswork. It's always guess. You never know. You always test, retest, try things, but you have a fairly good idea as to where you're trying to do, what you're trying to do.
And then, so if we start, I suppose, moving down the chain a little bit more towards the pelvis, what do you, because you talk a lot about kind of maybe even getting the pelvis into kind of a neutral position, maybe even a slight posterior tilt. And in the program, you talk about kind of getting your tailbone like slightly off the ground. And that's something I actually teach when we do our dead bugs and things like that, getting the ribs down and that kind of tailbone slightly up. And then we can really turn on kind of the deep core muscles. Mm-hmm. What's kind of the benefit of that? Because some people would argue as well, if we go back to that sprinting example that you talked about, that we're going to find ourselves when we sprint, maybe getting into this anterior position with kind of the leading with the chest expansion and things like that. So what's the advantage of kind of doing these maybe dead bug exercises, so to speak, mm-hmm. getting us in this correct position mm-hmm. before we kind of getting ourselves into this upright running position?
Mm-hmm. It's a good argument, and I see both sides. I definitely see both sides. I don't ever think that one position is better than another. So I'm always trying to be careful about that, and I don't want to become one of those like gurus who are saying you have to train in this way. You definitely don't. And a lot of people get good success doing all different things. So that just shows the
adaptability and the robustness of the human being. So that's the most important thing always to understand. But if I start that extended position, the ribs coming up and the pelvis coming forward, that will happen when I run. Now, most athletes actually that you see, really good athletes, and I do put a lot of it, like examples and stuff on my Instagram page, and you'll see that they actually aren't anywhere near as extended as people think. Some are, some aren't. But the problem is that when we do go and train like that in the gym, we are starting in that position. Then when we go and run, and now I'm nearly at my end range, my hamstring is stretched like hell already. It's been stretched from this end. Then as my knee goes to swing forward, or as my foot kind of swings forward before I hit the ground, it's been stretched from below as well. And that might be fine, but it might not also be fine. So I have no problem going into this position, but we don't want to start this position. I want in position, and that's what a powerlifter walks around like. And that's a strong position if you want to be strong and stiff, but we don't want to be strong and stiff. We want the pelvis to be able to kind of, it won't move as much as this now, but we want this alternation. And we want it to be able to go both sides. So posterior tilt is not good and anterior tilt is not good. I just want to be able to access both. And it goes back to variability. People cannot access that posterior tilt very well.
I think it's more about the education purposes behind kind of accessing that posterior and anterior tilt. And if you, I think I've heard you say this before actually, and it's 100% correct from my experiences. If you have to ask an athlete to kind of just tilt their pelvis forward, kind of empty the book at both sides, mm-hmm. guarantee they can't do it.
No.
And it's just giving them the, I suppose, and that's why I like the dead bug and things like that, giving them the feedback mechanism of the ground. Mm-hmm. Where you can actually press your lower back into the ground, access those deep core muscles, and then actually learn and figure out what it's like to like tilt and orientate the pelvis appropriately.
Yeah. So there's three big movements of the pelvis, but they definitely can't do that very well. They don't have very good control over that. And that's, in my view, that's absolutely huge. It's humongous to have. I have no problem with someone going into an anterior tilt. But one choice is no choice. If that's the only way you can move, then that's probably not a good thing. You don't even have a choice. If you want, if I want you to go into an anterior tilt, I want you to be able to. You need to be able to. But if every single time you squat, run, anything, it has to go there straight away, that's not a choice. So they definitely won't be able to do this. And they definitely, if they cannot do that, they can't get a frontal plane pelvis either. Mm-hmm. And frontal plane pelvis is really, really important, because that's one of the most strong positions in the world of sport. Is when I finish pushing off my right leg, for instance, that should get into something that's called like a hip lock position, where the opposite side gets higher and I get a full contraction of that right glute max here. So if I cannot get like good control in the sagittal plane, I probably won't be able to get good control in the frontal plane either. And that becomes an issue, because it becomes an issue, especially in a sport that I have to be able to change direction and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, 100%. That, like I know Franz Bosch talks a lot about that hip lock position, and it's being able to access, and the amount of athletes that can't do it again is amazing, is actually access that kind of, not even the glute, but or the glute med, but those like posterior fibers of that glute med, they're non-existent. And it's, I think, just from when I played around with this a few years ago, trying to get into that proper hip lock position, it took me a considerable amount of time to be able to actually like kind of find and understand kind of what's actually going on back there.
Yeah, exactly. And I would argue that you could have got there in, well, I don't know you but it personally, but in 20 minutes with some breathing work.
Right. Yeah, so that's the thing. I've never done any breathing work or anything like that. It was always focused around what's actually happening at the hip.
Yeah. So like we have to remember that the ribs are driving, having a big impact on what's happening at the hip. And so I'm fighting against myself then, because these muscles are not in anywhere an optimal length tension relationship, whatever optimal is, they're not there. So I'm trying to pull myself into these positions because sagittal plane is poor, frontal plane, I don't really access frontal plane. I can't access frontal plane very well when my sagittal plane is a mess. Mm-hmm. So
So yeah, I would argue you could get there very quickly. And something, just a practical thing for something, someone is, for instance, and this is, I'm not a big fan of the glute activation stuff and that, but what you will see is, let's say someone's lying on their left side here and their right leg is lying long, and they want to do like a leg lift on the right side. So they want to just lift up their foot and get some glute activation here. Mm-hmm. What they will do instead of that, instead of lifting up the foot and getting movement from the hip here, which will be a glute movement, they'll try and lift the foot and the pelvis will come back like this with it. So they're actually hiking up the right pelvis, and they're using a lot of QL and abdominals on the right side there. And so I am lifting the foot. I can get it super high, but I'm rocking the pelvis. Yep. That's not hip movement. Hip movement would be getting a hip lock. So pelvis goes this way, foot goes this way, hip goes this way. So that's control of the hip, and that's movement of the hip joint. This is a QL that's lifting me. And if I put that into standing, then a hip lock would be this push here.
Yeah.
That external rotation and abduction and extension, and then that frontal plane pelvis here, and it's a push like that. But instead of that, they cannot get this to happen. So they kind of everything comes together and there's no separation here.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. They don't understand how to get a proper like segmentation. I don't know if that's the right word or not, but
yeah. Yeah,
that's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah, and the segmentation, it is segmentation. It is relative motion of the joints, that they're relatively going in opposite directions, mm-hmm. of the bones. But it doesn't. You don't get that from training segmentation, if you get me. So like, you have to train, because there's FRC people and all this stuff, and they'll train a lot of that, those CARs and things like that will not carry over, in my opinion, to movement, because the coordination between the joints is not there.
Mm-hmm.
It might be good to open up the range if I need to open up the range, but it won't carry over to timing or coordination.
Yeah, so the timing's still going to be there from a whole system perspective.
Yeah.
So if we just move it down the, I know we're getting on for time a little bit here, so I'm keeping an eye.
No, I'm going all over the place. I usually don't get to use my models, so that's why I'm jumping all over the place.
So, but if we move down the chain again, to the foot this time, and then we talk about the importance of the function of the foot in the gait cycle, and essentially everything we do, because it's the only thing that's in contact, obviously, with the ground in sport. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of people, I think a good place to start would be the big toe, because a lot of people talk about you need to like work the big toe because it fires the glute. And I think equally the amount of people that say that probably don't have any idea what that actually means or how to do it. So do you mind just kind of breaking that down? What does that mean? How do we go about it?
Yep. I'll try to go as simple as I can. It's actually not about the big toe. It is, but it's a consequence of getting to the big toe and how I get to the big toe. I'll try and make this as simple as I can. So we'll use this that we spoke about earlier, this, the importance of being able to get a hip extension from an active glute to push me, rather than a knee extension. Does that, I know it makes sense to you, but do you think that'll make sense to other people how I'm describing that? So that my foot hits the floor, mm-hmm. I want my knee to be in an isometric when my foot hits the floor. So it just is a little bit flexed and it stays there. And that isometric around the knee allows then my glute and my, all my hip extensors to push me forward then. Mm-hmm. So my hip is coming forward to meet my knee, instead of my knee coming back to meet my hip, which would be, can't get an isometric, knee straightens too soon, and then I've no hip left to work with, really. Okay, so now I'm just falling. And you'll see that again and again and again with athletes if you slow it down and know what to look for. And you'll see them walking, people will do that as well. So if we presume that the things up above the hip are doing a decent job, then when my foot hits the floor, firstly, I need to have good amount of pretension around the calf, a certain amount of pretension around the calf, so that when the floor hits me effectively, not the foot hits the floor, the floor hits me, I'm ready for that. And my joints are safe. So that's really important. And there'll be pretension around the whole lower leg, really. So foot hits the floor. That should drive. If I strike in a decent area, and that will change depending on how fast I'm running and different things like that. But if I can time joints and muscles well, then I'm going to get activation around the calf, the hamstring, and the quadriceps around the knee. So that should be an isometric around the knee, which allows the active hip extension to push me forward. Now I've got my glute, because all of these things have timed up. The glute is a short, thick muscle, and it needs time to contract. It can't contract as quick as, say, the rec fem, the hamstrings, some of the calf muscles. They can contract much quicker. They're not as strong, but they can contract really, really quick and be really... that's why usually, as Bosch will say, that there's a lot of isometrics, like the hamstrings are designed to be contracting isometrically. Again, there's a debate around it, but I would tend to side towards him and say that he's probably right there. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not isometric, I think the intention of them is to be isometric. Even if they don't fully achieve that, I think they're trying to get that to happen. So if my foot doesn't strike well, if I can't get calf, hamstring, and quadriceps to contract together, then I'm getting that knee extension too soon, which means the glute has gone into end range and hasn't actually pushed me forward. So the people that talk about getting glute activation or foot to glute connection, they probably don't understand it, because the glute relies on all of these things that happen below it, but it's about timing. It's all about timing, that sequencing. Yeah. And then it goes glute, boom. And then either depending on the sport, depending on the athlete, the knee might go next. And so hip extension, knee extension, and then I'm going to get push off and go off the big toe. Now, in field sports athletes, a lot of the time you won't see full knee extension. You'll see glute and foot working. Because if I get full knee extension in a field sport, it's kind of push me forward and up and away from the floor. And now it takes me too long to get to the floor to make my next decision, which is not just running forward. I have to actually change position or whatever. So I've gone around about way of saying there, the foot, the glute is really only as good as the hamstring, the calf, and the foot. Mm-hmm. To do a good job to give it its chance to contract, because it needs time. The hamstrings are biarticular muscles. The rec fem, they can contract quickly, but they're not as strong. So yeah, so that will be landing in a more supinated position.
Yep.
I'll have a little bit of pronation, so a little bit of give in the midfoot. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to contract again and resupinate and get off that big toe and really push, and the foot will get really rigid and lock up so that I have something strong and stable to push off of. And that push off again happens, or should probably happen, with that frontal plane pelvis, like we spoke about. This is a left foot, so that it should be more like this. Uh-huh. So they both happen together. And so the hip will lock and the foot should lock together. But if I already have a locked foot, then I probably can't get that little bit of suspension at the foot that I need, that unlocking. And you'll see a lot of knee issues and Achilles issues then as well, because the knee, the force is going up into the body rather than being dispersed. Mm-hmm. If you look at the midfoot, like, all the complexity is there. The reason we have so many joints there is so that they can take load before it goes up into the body. And a huge part of my work for people with chronic Achilles issues, knee issues, is getting that foot to be able to load well. And they go and run, and people will say that they didn't have a strong enough Achilles tendon, they didn't have a strong enough patellar tendon. Actually, they just didn't have a foot that could disperse load away from those areas. Mm-hmm. And that's the really cool thing, because you'll see things change very, very quickly. Now we don't have to choose one or the other. I can still go and strengthen the tendons, mm-hmm. but I just don't want to ignore the other stuff that has an impact too.
Yeah, it's all transmitting force one way or another. And I think that's, I mean, this next, you don't have to go into the details in this next bit because this would be a whole episode potentially in itself. But when you talk about like pronation and supination, some people would say maybe, oh, you don't need to like pronate. And some people potentially would say you don't need to supinate. And I think what you're saying there is it's a give and take. There's got to be some, because without some pronation, there's no supination and things like this. So how do you kind of, what's your interpretation of that when it comes to, like, I think I kind of know the answer from what you've just said, but when it comes to that kind of force absorption and like propulsion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like any other joint in the body. There has to be a left and a right. There has to be a bit of both. So the people that will say like that the foot should not pronate, that's like saying supination, if we call supination left and pronation is right, then that's like saying you should look left, but never look right. They're two sides of the coin. And if I look left in my head and they say, yo, continue to supinate, keep supinating, supination is good, I'm like, well, I'm already here. Where am I supposed to go now? I have to go back to the middle or to the right to actually go back to the left. So if my foot is already locked and supinated, there is no loading left.
Yeah.
So I would have to have pronated in then to resupinate out. So the people that say supination is good, they don't understand it. I don't have to pronate my foot. I just have to go into some type. I have to pronate from where I was. So there has to be some kind of, I'm pronating out of supination, but I don't have to, that doesn't mean I have to go into a fully flat foot. I'm just pronating and supinating, just like I'm flexing and extending. I'm not staying in one. This is a supination, this is a pronation. Neither is good. We need both. And that's the same with every joint in my body. It needs to be able to access both sides. And depending on the task will tell me how much of both that I need to go into.
And do you think that's a little bit of an issue sometimes when people get stuck in maybe one camp? You can say this is wrong, but this is just kind of my opinion from speaking to some practitioners, is that you get, if we look at like an ACL mechanism for injury, is typically kind of foot eversion, pronation, talus drops, tibia internal rotation. Do you think that's kind of taking, like throwing the baby out with the bathwater? We're just saying, oh, this is the mechanism for ACL and it's multifactorial. That's not the only thing.
Yeah. I think so. And it could be a thing for someone that they go too much. But too much of anything is not good.
Yeah.
So it's just too much is a lack of control. Mm-hmm. And lack of control is not good. So but I would say that the people that fall into the camp that bring pronation for all ACLs, it's actually not pronation. Pronation is not a full eversion of the foot. Pronation is kind of this sagittal plane movement, this frontal plane movement, and a transverse plane movement. This is just the frontal plane movement of the entire foot.
Right.
And that becomes an issue if I don't have an agreement with the hip and the pelvis above it, that if they are not going there as well, that's not pronation. That's, it's just not pronation. That's again, there's people shouting from the rooftops demonizing pronation. I would argue that if someone that the people who are doing that cannot pronate their foot at all. This is a compensation because they don't know how to get loading through the midfoot. So the whole thing just rolls together. So are we supposed to avoid that position because they hurt their knee in it? Or are we supposed to educate it to move better when they go into that position and be stronger in that position? There's two sides, but I would favor the latter.
And then I know we really are getting on for time here, but I'm just really interested in, does that where the, some people would say, okay, in order to load that kind of midfoot, forefoot, so we can get some more kind of movement, that's when we need to go into barefoot training and things like this. Now, do you think, and it's kind of swings and roundabouts, because some people would say, oh, now we need to do everything barefoot, which is, in my opinion, not the way to go. What's kind of your opinion on that? Do you think you need a little bit of barefoot to be able to kind of get that kind of movement reinstated in there?
Good question. I don't think we need it. I think it could it can help. I don't think we need it. I think it's an option. It comes back to education, right? Because I can train someone to pronate and supinate their feet better in shoes than most people who are in the barefoot movement can do in barefoot. So it comes back to where the joint, and that's not me, like loads of people can do that.
Yeah.
So it just comes back to education and understanding what pronation is and supination is, how it pairs with the knee and the hip and the spine and the jaw and the shoulder, and all of these joints pair together to make a foot shape and a body shape. And Gary Ward is incredible at talking about these things. And it, the people who go barefoot will not change the shape of their bones or how their feet move if they don't know how. They will just continue to go barefoot. Their foot might get a bit stronger, which is good, but the movement of the bones won't improve. It might improve if they go and hike and barefoot and stuff like that. But unfortunately, if you're just in the gym and you're going barefoot, the foot is designed for like stepping on a twig and a rock and feeling all these different surfaces and the sensory aspect of it. I do see a lot of people actually whose feet move worse when they go barefoot, because they, and this gets very complicated, but there's, the feet are obviously huge sensory organs. They're, your brain needs to feel your feet to know where it is in space, really. And when we take away shoes for some people, we take away an arch, and now the brain can't feel the arch, because there's, in a shoe there's usually something pressing into the arch.
Yep.
And It's a big thing for the brain. It can feel it. So when it can feel something, it can relax something. Mm-hmm. If I take away that arch and I walk around barefoot and I don't have a good sense of my feet already, and my movement is not amazing, or not amazing, my movement is not decent already, mm-hmm. there's a good chance that the brain will tighten this stuff up completely, because it now it's taking away even more sensory information. So the sensory conversation is interesting, very important, and misunderstood, because people think, oh, I feel the ground so much better in my feet when I'm barefoot. You consciously might, but where you're feeling your feet is important. Mm-hmm. Where on the ground you're feeling your feet, and people don't do that very well in barefoot a lot of the time, I would say. So it's a difficult topic.
Yeah.
But I'm not too quick at taking people out of bare, like I don't think I've prescribed someone to walk or to say just go barefoot without giving them drills that will improve how their bare feet will move.
Okay. Do you think there's merits in doing your kind of warm-up routines barefoot, whether it be just different, I don't know, lunge patterns, for example, crawling patterns barefoot, just to get to increase that sensory feedback?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's helpful. That's really good. Oh, there's Siri. All right. The barefoot stuff is definitely helpful. It can be definitely helpful. And it's important to strengthen the feet and be able to do those things. But it just requires a bit of nuance, because not necessarily you can go and do all that stuff and you might start to move really well, but the whole conversation requires a bit of nuance, because the barefoot movement are saying everyone should be barefoot, mm-hmm. and that's not the case.
It's never black and white.
No, just look, that's my answer to every single question. Yeah, is
no, that's fair
enough. There's all these things that we can do, and there's so many people sitting in all these camps, because one, that's human nature to want to be part of something, and two, I could make a shit ton of money if I talked about feet all this time and said this was the way. There's a lot of people that ask me questions on Instagram all day long, and I really could make a lot of money, but it's not ethical. It's not the way to go, and we have to, there's enough people just taking hard stances on things without understanding things. So for me, I always want to just sit on the fence and hopefully see both sides and make an informed decision from there.
Yeah, I think it's one of those frustrating answers with a lot of things, where it's always, it depends.
Yeah.
And it's never black and white as we'd like it to be. David, I'd just like to say thank you ever so much for coming on. I know we've kind of went a little bit longer than we planned, but hopefully everyone really appreciates that. I think there's been some fantastic kind of knowledge bomb, so to speak, kind of dropped in there. Just before we go, where can people find you if they want to reach out, grab hold of your kind of lower body basics program, which I would highly recommend? So there's your plug.
Yeah, thank you. Instagram is probably a good place to go. Just David Gray, G-R-E-Y, rehab. And I'm working on my website at the moment, so I won't, or I'm not, I have something else working on for me, so I won't send anyone to my website because it's poor, but it will be better soon. But if people are interested in some of the stuff I suppose we talked about, hopefully some people are, hopefully I didn't make it too complicated. I always try and make it as simple as possible, and I guess today I probably elaborated a little bit because I had the models and stuff. So if people are interested and intrigued, I definitely never want anyone to feel like they're like, oh, this guy he's talking and he's trying to make things complicated and explain things in a certain way. I don't, because that's where I was in the past, listening to people, and it didn't help, and it doesn't help for this mystique around things, and this, it should just make sense. So I hope that it makes sense. And if people want to go to my Instagram and check out some of that stuff, they can go there. And if they don't like it, then obviously they're not going to go anywhere else. And if they do, they'll, and they're interested, they will definitely see my Instagram probably every single day. Instagram is probably the best place to go.
Definitely. So yeah, I'd just like to say thank you ever so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I know the viewers will, because it has been some high quality content. So thank you very much. And then have a good day.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
No worries.